We'll begin in our Bibles tonight in Isaiah 59. Back in October, I brought a challenge to the deacons, and when I finished, Pastor said, "You'll have to bring that on next time you preach." And so I said, "Well, okay, if I can remember." So I thought of that when he gave me the opportunity to speak tonight. So we'll look at this, and I've added to it, so Kenny won't fall asleep on me because he was there, and I wouldn't want him to do that. So we'll look at Isaiah 59. I want to tonight talk about when truth falls in the street. Now, before we get to that, I want to tell you something that's kind of special to me. Today's a special day for me. It's kind of my 14th of Nissan. You say, what's that? Is that four wheels and a gas tank? The 14th of Nissan. This is my 14th of Nissan. What is the 14th of Nissan? Can you hear?
Nissan, I believe, is a month in the Bible.
It's a month in the Bible. It's a seventh month, but it's the first religious month on the religious calendar, and it is Passover. What was the Passover? Passover is when the blood was applied, and the death angel saw the blood applied, and the death angel passed over all the homes where the blood was applied, and where the blood was not applied, the firstborn was taken. Of course, that was the Egyptian homes. But they were to eat that Passover that night, killing the lamb, the paschal lamb. They were to eat it with bitter herbs. They were to eat it with their shoes on their feet, because they had to be ready to go. But Passover, on the 14th of Nisan, is actually a picture of our salvation. We've been passed over by the death angel. We've passed from death unto life. We're passed over, and we are saved, and that is my 14th of Nisan. You all have one if you're a Christian. Each one of us, the day you're saved, that's your Passover. That's when the death angel passed over because he saw the blood applied, and your name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life, forever settled from the foundation of the world, and you are saved and secure because of your having been passed over, and he has brought you into his fold. Now, how important is this Holy Week to me? Because it was exactly 55 years ago tonight that I was saved. Exactly 55 years ago. It happened to be the 5th of August, 1964, but it was a Wednesday night. My church was having its prayer meeting, and my aunt raised her hand and said, "Pray for Gordon. He's at camp. He needs to know the Lord." And I thought of that this week. Our kids are at camp. And as far as we know, all of our kids know the Lord, but there will be kids at camp saved this week. The pastor of our last church was saved at age 15 at camp, at the Wiles, actually. And I was saved when I was 15 in 1964. What is interesting about this Holy Week for me is the very next day, something happened that also changed my life forever. I saw for the first time that young lady sitting right back there. She was just a squirt. She was 13 years old, and I was 15. And she and her friend Shirley got up to sing. They sang a song. Some of you might not know it. It's called "Nothing But Leaves for the Master." It's about the master coming with his disciples to the fig tree, and the time of figs was on, and yet there were no figs on that tree, just leaves. And remember, he cursed the fig tree, and it said, "Let nothing grow on thee from henceforth." No more figs. And you'd think that'd be the end of it. But the next day, the disciples came and they saw that fig tree. You know what happened to it? It was completely withered away. Why? Because there's no purpose for the fig tree without figs. The lesson for us, there's no purpose for us without fruit. And this song, the chorus says, "Nothing but leaves for the master. Oh, how his loving heart grieves when instead of the fruit he is seeking, We offer him nothing but leaves. And Lillian and Shirley were singing that song. And while they were singing it, I'm watching. I had just been dumped by the pastor's daughter. And I was hungry. I was drooling, salivating. And I saw Lillian. Now, I want you to know that none of that was in my thought. I saw her, and I saw her singing. I had not noticed it before. I saw her singing with her friend Shirley. And Shirley, in the middle of this song, like sometimes teenagers do, started to blubber. She just kind of lost composure. And Lillian stopped. 13-year-old Lillian stopped. She looked at Shirley. She kind of waited for Shirley to get her composure. And I think Lillian said something, and they started again and got through the song, Nothing But Leaves for the Master. And I said in my heart, Lord, that is the kind of girl I'd like to marry someday. It even blows my mind to think of it. And I didn't think about it the rest of that week. She is way too much out in front for me. What was I just saved the day before? I was a wicked sinner. I didn't deserve a girl like that. But the next camp came in the fall, different place, same group, and we went to camp, and I saw her again. And at the end of the camp, we sort of exchanged addresses, and we started writing. We wrote for about 6 years. And something else kind of neat, that, by the way, was 55 years ago tomorrow. 49 years ago tomorrow, we were married. I think it's a neat story. This is my Holy Week. Can you understand it? It is. It's a very special week for me. If you could imagine the kind of sinner that I might have been, and I was everything you can imagine, and then take it down a few notches, that's where I was, and the Lord saved me, and he gave me all of that. And it's such a wonderful blessing and benefit to have a great Christian family and a wife that has made all that possible. Let's look at Isaiah 59, and I want to take this and another passage of Scripture with it as well. And it's because this in itself doesn't give us the conclusion that I want to have. So in Isaiah 59, I want you to notice what happens when truth falls in the street, so that equity, that is, it cannot pass. And we'll look at that in just a minute. But we have here in three different things in this passage. I'll start in verses 1 through 3, and I'll go down through those verses, and I'll talk about that for a minute. He says, Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy, that it cannot hear, but your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue hath muttered perverseness. I want you to notice that. This is a very familiar passage of Scripture. Notice the pronoun that is used to describe the people that Isaiah is addressing. And that pronoun would be you or yours. You. He's talking about believers. And he's talking about believers' problems. So I'm saying here, this is a picture of saints stumbling. Our iniquities have separated between us and our God. And it is not that God cannot hear us. It's that he just says, I will not hear you if your hands are defiled. That's a very, very serious matter. Lily and I talk about this kind of thing quite a bit, but there are certain things that she, as a lady, does not do because her godly mother didn't do them. There are things I don't do as a man, because my mother said those things are wrong. I cannot do certain things because she said they're wrong. Don't do them. And I believe that we are living in a day of permissiveness to such a point that Christian homes and Christian parents many times don't even instruct their kids as to what's right and wrong. You kind of leave it up to the kids. Make your own calls. I think that is why, and I could go on in this, and I'm not going to because of who we are and where we are tonight. It's not necessary. But let me just say that we have churches all over this area that tell you, tell their people, it's okay to be a social drinker. It's okay. And their standards have gone down, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the tip of it. And there are Christian homes where they have it, and there are Christian homes where there is various filth that is seen in media, and they watch this stuff, and they put up with this stuff, and they wonder why their kids don't turn out right, or why their kids are just a few notches down from where they are. And that's because there's no standard in the home. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but saints today, folks, are stumbling, and those three verses talk about that fact. You, he's talking about saints. Then the whole thing changes. Look at verses 7 and 8. There, I could go back farther, but I'll just start with 7 and 8. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they have not, they know not, and there is no judgment in their goings. They have made them crooked paths. Whosoever goeth therein shall not know peace. Now tell me the pronoun that's used there. They and their. Different group. The first group was believers. Now we're looking at sinners, and we know they're sinners specifically because Romans 3 quotes this passage and says this is where we were. This is the sinful world in which we live. We live there, and that's how we live. That's where I was before I was saved. So not only do saints stumble, but sinners, lost people, stumble, and they get worse and worse and worse. And I have heard people say, well, you know, our day may not be worse than all other days. And it's probably that's true. There have been periods of time in world history where things have really, really gotten awful, wicked, where governments can just kill people by the thousands and millions. We know that that has happened. And so there are times that are worse. But there has never been a time in my lifetime, your lifetime, where there's been such vitriol and such wicked speech against other people politically and moral people. We're not talking about just political people. We're talking about moral people. And sometimes there are really wicked things that are said about moral people. And so sinners today are in that camp, and that's where they are, and they're stumbling. So saints are stumbling, and sinners are stumbling. And when you have that happen, society is stumbling. And that's where, as a whole, society has gone down this drain. Look at verse 14. And this was my challenge to the deacons. We were in the Kavanaugh hearing time when Blasey Ford came and witnessed before the, took a whole week, basically, and tied up Washington, D.C., and tied up the newspapers for a week to testify against a man who was not a perfect man. But he didn't do any of the things that she said. Now, do I know that for absolute certainty? No, I don't. But in a court of law, I know it for certainty. If I were on a jury, I'd have to say, no, he didn't do any of that. Because it has to be proven, and it was nothing proven. There was not a witness corroborating anything she said. So it was during that time in October that I said to the men, this is what's happened. And if you look at verse 14, I'll start in verse 13. In transgressing and lying against the Lord and departing away from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood, and judgment is turned away backward, and justice standeth afar off, for truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. I'll read verse 15. Yea, truth faileth, and he that departeth from evil, notice this, maketh himself a prey. And I'll stop with that. If you want to make yourself a prey, live a righteous life. That's what he's saying. The person who lives a righteous life becomes a prey. Stand up anywhere and say, thus saith the Lord, and see if it doesn't get you in trouble. Stand up anywhere and say that. School, in the halls of science, academia, politics, say it anywhere. Say it in a town hall. Say it in a courthouse. In some places, say it in a church. There are churches today that blaspheme the name of Christ and think nothing of it. And what I want to spend time on just a little bit tonight is verse 14. I want you to see those four legal terms in verse 14. He says, and judgment is turned away backward. The word judgment means the ability to know right from wrong. Right from wrong, and the knowledge of right and wrong is turned away backward. We don't know the difference. Killing a baby. Who would ever have thought, when you and I were young, some of us, when we were young, could you imagine that in America we could actually applaud the idea of killing a baby after it's born? And they did that in New York State Legislature. So how in the world does that happen in America? Well, we don't know right from wrong. In verse 14, and judgment is turned away backward. The word justice, then, that's the second legal word, means right. What's right? Right. We don't know right from wrong. And if you don't know right from wrong, you're going to stand afar off. Why? Because if you stand out in the street, if you are for right, you're going to get run over. And that's why Kavanaugh was attacked. He was attacked because he stood for justice. He stood because he said, right is not the same as wrong. And I know the difference between right and wrong. Now, he didn't know. He didn't go far enough down that road. You know that. When I went over some things in class one time, I love Anne. She's so quiet and meek. I just love her. She said, well, you know, he wouldn't have had any problem at all. Kavanaugh would have had no problem at all if he'd never touched the booze. Probably wouldn't have, except they'd have found something else. But that'll get you in trouble. If you say you like it, well, then all they got to do is say, hey, he's a slobbering drunk. And that's what they said. So judgment, that is, the knowledge of right and wrong, is turned away backward, and justice, right, that is, doing right, standeth far off because it's going to get run over. And then truth, that's the third legal term. The word here means steadfastness. Truth, steadfastness, is like that much rubble in the street. Steadfast, if a man is steadfast, he gets run over, literally. And he's out there, he's just literally torn apart by the masses that just rail against him and speak against him and lie about him. This person, steadfastness, is fallen in the street. Truth is fallen in the street. So that equity, and that's your fourth legal term, equity, is the only place this word is used in the Bible, means straightforwardness. And what that means is you cannot, in a situation like this and in a society like that, you cannot go straight forward. You go straight forward and there's rubble in the street. That which is called truth has been destroyed. There is no truth anymore. Everything is relative. There's no truth, and truth is fallen in the street, and that which is going straight forward has to go around so that equity or straightforwardness cannot pass. See, well, that's kind of a negative message, and it is. But this chapter does not end with that negative message. You'll get to verse 19. So they shall fear the name of the Lord from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall raise up a standard against him. I love that verse. I've always loved that verse. When the enemy comes in like a flood, and a flood, by the way, is about one of the most destructive things out there. It just takes everything in its path. When the enemy comes in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord raises up a standard against him. And the Lord will do that. For us, I tell Lillian every day, if the Lord didn't come today, he's probably coming tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to that day. And not just because I don't love life. I love life. I enjoy life. I enjoy my work. I don't play much, but I enjoy my work. And I enjoy what I do. But I'm looking forward to Jesus coming. Because he takes me, he takes you, he takes my children, he takes us to be in the presence of the Lord forever and ever. So shall you ever be with the Lord. And no more sin, no more sorrow, no more separation. I'm going to be with him forever. I'm looking forward to that day. So he is coming to save us. Now, are there examples of such truth problems in the New Testament. Other examples, and of course there are. You could go through John's Gospel and you could see that again and again and again. Something like about 60 years after Herod asked, probably in the hearing of John the Apostle, what is truth? John answered that in 3 John. And I want us to see that little book of 3 John, and that'll be our some closing thoughts tonight, 3 John. There's enough in 3 John, I could make the whole message about it, but I told Pastor I'd try to do that Isaiah 59 passage sometime, and so I did. But I want you to look here at 3 John. Only four little one-chapter books in the New Testament. 3 John is one of them. But what a powerhouse it is. There are three men that I want you to see here. And so I'm going to call this passage, How Three Men Reacted to the Truth. When truth cannot pass, when truth is fallen in the street so equity cannot pass, what do men of the truth do? And we have two examples of men of the truth and what they did with it, and one that didn't do so well with it. Okay, let's take a look at those three. Let me tell you the men. The men are Gaius. He's the one to whom the letter was written. Then there's the man Diotrephes. He's one that didn't do so hot. And then there is Demetrius, and we have him, and he is a man of truth. Let's take a look at these three. And this is not a long study, and we'll be finished before the pastor usually gets done. So I want you to see these things, and I want you to see, put this with that truth falling in the street. And John's day was just as bad as any day in the Old Testament and worse than ours. They were coming after John. And they caught him finally and banished him to the Isle of Patmos. And they would have killed they would have killed him if it had been possible to do that. And so his day was a pretty bad day. But they were men of the truth. And so what about it? By the way, truth is used many, many times in this little one-chapter book. And it's a book. The theme is truth. So, Gaius. First of all, he personified the truth. And verses 1 through 8, you see that. I'll go ahead and read the book. You can tell Pastor I read a whole book in the Bible that way. And look at verse 1. The elder, that's John, unto the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in good health, even as thy soul prospereth. Interesting how he has that backwards from the way most people think of it. We get that backwards. He said, I wish that you would be in good health, even as your soul is in good health. Most of us are wishing our good health, physical health, to people, and we don't care so much about the soul. But he said, I want you to be in as good health physically as you are spiritually. That's a good point. For I rejoice greatly when the brethren came and testified of the truth that is in, there's the word truth again, the truth that is in thee, even as thou walkest in the truth, there it is again, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Verse 4 probably means what? What's the relationship between Gaius and John? No greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. John probably led him to the Lord. It is almost certain that would be the way you would say that. And Paul said, I have many children, but you don't. I didn't get that right. I forgot how that goes. I'll have to restudy that. But he said, I've got no greater joy than to hear that my children, those that are saved under my ministry, are walking truth. John had pastored the church at Ephesus for a long time before he was banished to the Isle of Patmos, where he wrote the book of the Revelation. But here, He's recalling time back, apparently. John is about the same age here as he is as he writes. So he's not probably on the Isle of Patmos, but he's at the very near that same age, and he's writing to this man who has no greater joy than to hear that this son of his in the faith is walking in truth. And by the way, four times he calls him beloved, and he starts that in verse 5. Beloved. No, it's the second time. Beloved, thou doest faithfully whatsoever thou doest to brethren and to strangers. He said, you are loving people in the church just like you love strangers, like you love people outside of the church. So he's personifying the truth. And he lives the truth, he walks in the truth, he loves in the truth. And this man, Gaius, is a man who personifies truth. He said, which have borne, these people that have told me about you have borne witness of thy charity before the church, whom if thou bring forward on their journey after a godly sort, thou shalt do well. Because for his name's sake, that's Jesus, that's it. His name, Jesus, is not mentioned in the little book of 3 John, but this is as close as we're going to get. Because for his name's sake, they went forth taking nothing of the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such that we might be fellow helpers, here it is again, to the truth. Gaius was a fellow helper to the truth. He walked in the truth. He loved in the truth. He was loved in the truth because he was a man of truth. And that's how we should be in this very dark world where truth is fallen in the street and equity cannot pass. Then we come to the man Diotrephes. Diotrephes was, and by the way, Gaius might have been the pastor of the church. We're not told, we don't know. But the letter was written to him, was addressed to him, and it might very well have been the pastor, we're just not told. But we get to Diotrephes, who was a big shot in the church. He probably wasn't the pastor, but he wished he were, and he was a hot shot, and he's no good. I wrote unto the church, John said in verse 9, but Diotrephes, who loveth to have the preeminence among them, receiveth us not. We don't know anything about this letter that John wrote to the church before he wrote this one to Gaius. We don't know anything about that letter. It was thrown away. Diotrephes got rid of it. He loved himself more than he loved God, and he just said, I don't care about John. I don't care about his letter. What he's got to say is not important, and he got rid of it. Can you imagine destroying the Word of God? And that's kind of what you would, it'd be like one of those kings in the Old Testament took a penknife and chopped up Jeremiah's, the scribe's work. He had written a great work, a prophetic work, and the king cut it up and threw it in the fire. Diotrephes did something similar. Verse 10, wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds, which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith. But does this sound like our day or what? Not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and casteth them out of the church. Beloved, follow that which is not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, but he that doeth evil hath not seen God. Boy, that is quite an indictment of Diotrephes. I don't think Diotrephes was saved. He was certainly a fellow traveler, certainly had given a profession of faith at some time, had become a leader in the church, but I don't think Diotrephes was a saved man at all. And John says, I'm going to remember this man with prating words. What are prating words? Prating words are idle, to talk in idle words profusely and foolishly. He just goes on and on and on about John and how absolutely useless John's work was. And anything about John, he brought malicious words and malicious smears against John. Prating words, idle words, profuse words, foolish words, and tried to destroy John. By the way, it sounds again like people around us all the time. Thankfully, we get to another word, another man, another man of the truth. If Gaius was a man of the truth, Demetrius, who's a man of the truth, Diotrephes is right in the middle. By the way, Diotrephes loved to have the preeminence. You know what that meant? He wanted to be number one. Preeminence. If you look it up, it means he wants to be number one. Preeminent. You know the word preeminent is used only one other time in the New Testament? And you know where it says that? That in all things. That in all things he might have the preeminence. It's on Sarah Morris's prayer letter, the prayer card. That in all things he might be preeminent. And either Jesus is preeminent, number one, or ourselves. We make ourselves preeminent, and we can never be more preeminent than any other. We should put ourselves even below others. And we really, Jesus first, others second, ourselves last, wouldn't be a bad motto to live by. And Diotrephes had it all backwards. Now Demetrius, in verse 12, hath a good report of all men, and, notice, of the truth itself. Yea, we also bear record, and ye know that our record is true. That sounds like what John says in 1 John a number of times. He said, I had many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto thee, but I trust I shall shortly see thee, and shall speak face to face. Peace be to thee. Our friends salute you. Greet the friends by name. I would say that Demetrius, oh, by the way, Diotrephes perverted the truth. Gaius personified the truth. And Demetrius promoted and published truth. What was Demetrius? He was probably the one to whom John entrusted to take this letter to Gaius. He was probably the one who carried it. He probably had beautiful feet. You know that? Beautiful upon the mountain are those that publish good tidings. He was that kind of a man. He took the word of God with joy. It was worth risking his life. He was a man who promoted the truth by the life he lived, and he published the truth even at the risk of his life. And you and I should be willing to do that. And I think in this day it's a very likely possibility that very soon we'll start to see some persecution in some serious ways, not necessarily physical, but maybe financial. We may have to suffer some things financially. We may lose some things. We may lose some privileges. I do expect that that could happen in my lifetime if Jesus doesn't come today. Are we ready for that? Stand with the truth. I thank God for a pastor who preaches the truth. Someone said to me years ago, they saw me in a grocery store and said, I visited your church a couple times and said, I noticed that every time you preach, you always preach the Bible. And I says, what else is there to preach? I don't have anything worthwhile. Our pastor preaches the book. I'm glad for that. I told the Lord a lot of years ago that when I retired, I would love to find somebody who really preached the book, stayed with the book, that I could encourage and help. Well, I don't have to encourage him very much. He's a man of great encouragement. He's a great encouragement to me, but I thank the Lord for him, and I thank the Lord that I can be in the church where he's my pastor. Pray for him every day. I'm sure you do too. Okay, prayer request time. We don't have prayer sheets tonight.